This episode of Walter Edgar's Journal is an encore of a previously broadcast program.
Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me in the Scanner studio today is Professor John M. Coggeshall from Clemson University. He goes by Mike. And he's written a very interesting book, the very title of which some folks might think is a little bit contradictory to what they know about the mountains of South Carolina. And it's called Liberia, South Carolina, an African-American Appalachian Community. So, Mike, welcome to the Journal.
Thank you, Walter. It's a real pleasure to be here.
And our listeners always like to know something about our guests. So let's talk about where you came from and how did you end up in Clemson University?
Okay. I was actually born in Boston, but my parents only lived there for a few months and spent most of my young life in the St. Louis area on the Missouri side and then on the Illinois side. I came to Clemson in 1988 to develop an anthropology program, and I've been there ever since.
Okay, but you did your graduate work at Southern Illinois?
Southern Illinois University, Carbondale, okay. Right.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned being born in Boston, and your family name probably has colonial roots in Rhode Island?
Actually, my family is originally from Rhode Island. They settled there in 1632, and we do have a South Carolina branch. That's true. I've never met anybody with my same last name in South Carolina. Okay. But
all right. Well, what led you to this story?
Well, it actually started out by coincidence. I'm working on another book that was the original plan to study the mountain cultures of upstate South Carolina, the relationship between people and land. And as I was beginning to do some interviews, I came upon a place name called Liberia Road in Upper Pickens County, South Carolina. And I thought that seemed kind of an anomaly because typically we associate the Appalachians in general, upstate South Carolina is more of a Scots-Irish or German area. And so it seemed an out-of-place place name. And so I went up there one afternoon and stopped at the crest of this hill. It was an incredibly beautiful scene with the Blue Ridge in front of me. And I stopped to take a picture, and a white van came driving down a driveway, and an African-American woman stuck her head out the window and asked if she could help me. And I said I was looking for a place called Liberia, and she said, "This is it. My name is Mabel Owens Clark, and my family's been here for five generations." And that's how I met Mabel. That's how I discovered or came upon the community called Liberia, and then I got sidetracked on this project and have only just returned to my Mountain Cultures book.
Well, you address one of the questions that people might say, well, we didn't know that there were African Americans in the upcountry. They typically think the Carolina upcountry was mostly all white. Not in 1860. Mm-hmm. Actually, Pickens County was the whitest county in South Carolina in 1860, but it was roughly 22% African American. Even such upcountry counties as Abbeville, 65% African American. Chester, 61%. York, well, not quite a black majority, 47%. Spartanburg, 31%. Greenville, a third African American. So there was a much larger African American presence in the upcountry, even in Greenville, Spartanburg, and Pickens, than people imagined.
Mm-hmm. I was quite surprised to discover it. I had always associated I had done some other research in the Ozarks years and years ago, but I was surprised to discover. And then as I started doing research, not only is this community relatively common, but there were a lot of other settlements, communities of freed slaves in the upstate, because there were a lot of relatively large numbers of enslaved African Americans prior to the Civil War. So they had to go someplace. They wanted to stay near their lands that they had farmed all their lives, perhaps, and yet they wanted to be a little bit away from their former owners. And so a lot of these enclaves were developed in upstate South Carolina, and in fact, all over the South. As I started doing research, I discovered that there were these very similar kinds of freed slave enclaves from Texas all the way through to Virginia. And it when you think about it, it makes perfectly good sense. But it's not something that's typically thought of. That's true.
Well, probably the best known in South Carolina is Promised Land in Abbeville County, and made famous because of the people who came from there. So when did you meet Ms. Clark for the first time?
Well, it's 2007. And the reason I'm smiling is I was just talking about this the other day. It seems like a long time between the first time I met her and the actual publication of the book. But it wasn't the only thing that I was working on in those 11 years. But that's the time frame, yeah.
Well, you open with a fairly dramatic scene that Ms. Clark related to you. Do you want to describe that?
Well, I wanted to think of a way to start the story. And so I tried to think about perhaps maybe the most dramatic single event in the history of the community that I think became a fulcrum for thinking about negative and then positive or pre and post. And so I started out with the burning of the old Soapstone Baptist Church in April 1967 by some local members of the Ku Klux Klan. Not only was it the church that burned, but a local house, an empty house nearby, African-American-owned house, also burned. So arson was highly suspected. And so I wanted to open with that dramatic event as sort of the potential for the destruction of the community. And yet what was really gratifying to learn is that even though the church had been burned, almost immediately after the burning of the church, both blacks and whites teamed together to obtain money and obtain building materials to restore the church and maintain that community, which still exists today.
Soapstone Baptist Church is the key identity for that community.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Typically, in these newly established African-American communities, churches and schools were really significant institutions. And the school, of course, closed in the 50s when rural schools were consolidated, but the church is still there. And congregation only has about 8 members, but this is one of the reasons why, in fact, it's the primary reason why Mabel Clark has these fish fries, is to generate some income for the community in order to pay off the mortgage on the church. And so she's doing her best to keep the church alive.
And there's also a nearby Mount Nebo,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
which is another African-American mm-hmm. Baptist church. And both of these churches are American Baptist, mm-hmm. Affiliated with what was then, in right after the Civil War, considered the Northern Baptist Church.
Oh.
Let's back up to Ms. Clark's ancestors. You've got a genealogy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think it's important to take this community through its development, and it is still there as a community with a few individuals, but it's not what it was in 1866 or 1867.
That was one of the things that I wanted to document, was approximate numbers of people, because there's an oral history that there were hundreds and hundreds of freed slaves living in the area in 1866. And the census comes close to substantiating that. It depends on the area that we're talking about, but there were certainly hundreds of freed slaves in 1865. And then throughout the decades, actually the numbers went up during Reconstruction. At least percentages remained stable. But after about 1890, 1900, the population declined significantly. And by the 1950s, there was only really one extended family left. But what was surprising, I guess pleasantly surprising to me, was that if I looked at the census figures, the actual census records, and put together a lot of secondary sources, I was able to trace extended families through decades of time. And so one of my goals, I think, for the book was to humanize these people, to present names and photographs and a few anecdotes of history together in one collected entity that could add a significant portion of upstate South Carolina's history to the history of the state. So I am able to trace the generations through people through 5 generations.
We're talking about the church is actually on Soapstone Mountain?
There's there's a block of soapstone exposed.
A block of soapstone. Yeah. And given what everybody was doing in the 19th century, they were farmers. How good is the land?
Well, that was part of the reason why the community was established in the first place, is that the nearest larger river is the Illinois, and the Illinois Valley is not as extensive as Kiowa or Jocassee, but the Illinois Valley is pretty good floodplain corn fields, and that's where a lot of the local white landowners had most of their extensive landholdings. Liberia was established in relatively poor soils, more hilly, much tiny little valley that Maple's family owns directly, closer to the Blue Ridge, off the main valley of the Illinois. And so local legend has it that the reason why that land was obtained by freed slaves, it was relatively poor. Mabel's father apparently made a go of it, having a farm there, and others had farms there for years, but it's certainly not the kind of flat floodplain land that would be much more amenable for agriculture. And I think another reason, in fact, based on other research, another reason why the community was established off the main valley is it also gave a little bit more privacy to the African-American community, so that they could maintain their own cultural traditions and their own ways of life and their own secrets out of the purview of white landowners.
That's something that folks have found in studying South Carolina African Americans after the Civil War. Although some left the area in which they had lived, others stayed in the general area because they had an attachment to the land. Mm-hmm. Which is interesting considering that they were enslaved on it, but that was the land they had worked. So they wanted to stay in that general area.
Exactly. It was an area that they were familiar with technically, technologically. It was an area that they were familiar with emotionally. It was an area that they were familiar with. Also, they wanted to remain close in case former family members came back looking for them. Husbands separated from wives, children from parents. They knew where their family had been, and so that is also true. And there's an interesting document that I found from the Union forces, occupying forces in 1866, that was pretty common concern for the federal soldiers, federal administrators, is to help African Americans move from the Lowcountry back upstate or from upstate down to Lowcountry where they had been separated. And so that was also a pretty strong draw, I think, to remain where you were in case people needed to find you again.
How did these former slaves get this particular plot of land?
That's also a very good question. And research for a lot of these black enclaves shows kind of similar patterns. There are several possible reasons. First of all, I should say, the local white histories talk about how the former slaveholders were generous and gave the land to their former slaves. I find that a little suspicious, and then starting to do some research on Reconstruction history and African-American enclaves, a much more likely explanation was that in spring of 1865, slaveholders planted the crops with enslaved labor. October 1865, the crops were still in the field, the slaves were free. Former slave owners had no capital, had no money. Slaves needed labor. They needed to be paid and compensated for their labor now. And so basically it was a trade-off. If you agree to harvest our crops, we will then give you something in compensation. And the most likely capital the slave owners had was actually land. So I think it was a trade-off, trading land for labor. And in fact, there's a lot of documentation to that. And I think that's the most likely reason. There's at least one family legend that suggests a former slave was given his property by his former white mistress, and that's also a possibility. And it could have been, offspring of freed slave owners too. Sometimes got land or acquired material too. So, but I think generally it was a trade-off for labor for land.
Why did you think that you were suspicious of the fact that former owners were giving their ex-slaves land?
Just seemed a little bit less likely that given the antagonism that and the fear that former white slave owners had for their freed slaves, it seemed a lot less likely that – it's a possibility, of course, but it just seemed a lot less likely. Local whites were really afraid. There's a really interesting journal entry from Floride Clemson talking about how in the summer of 1865, local white landowners were terrified that you had huge numbers of freed slaves looking for land, looking for labor, looking for material. And there was a widespread panic in the state generally. And I can understand that. I mean, you had – it was an interesting period in American history. You had a huge number of formerly enslaved human beings now freed and needing work and needing capital and needing land and needing material. And it was a big problem for the United States.
Mike, we need to pause for a moment, sure. Let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Professor John Mike Coggeshall from Clemson University about his book, Liberia, South Carolina, An African-American Appalachian Community. Mike, when we were talking about the African-American population upstate, and I found this out in giving talks in various places. Well, there were no large slave owners here. Mm-hmm. We know from the census that every county or district, as it were called then, in the state had at least one individual that owned more than 100 slaves, except for Anderson County. That's the only – Pickens County, yes. Mm. Greenville County, Spartanburg County, Union County, obviously Abbeville County. So it's fascinating how between 1865 and – World War One, the idea that there was a large black population in the real upcountry counties came to be part of accepted history.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the reasons why I wanted to – I mean, one of the pleasures of writing this book, too, is to remind people of relatively significant numbers of African Americans have been in upstate South Carolina since – certainly the 1840s, at least.
When you were trying to track land titles using courthouse records and what have you, it wasn't as easy as you thought to trace ownership from 1865.
Well, actually, I didn't. As a cultural anthropologist, I tend to focus more on interviewing contemporary peoples. I was relying on Jim Meginson's research. Jim Meginson, a historian, wrote a very comprehensive book of African Americans in upstate South Carolina. And so I relied to a large amount on his statements about not being able to find a lot of land titles. And having done some background research, I discovered that that was fairly common throughout the South. A lot of African Americans didn't obtain land titles for a number of reasons. One is that they were often off the beaten track, off the main roads, out of the main valleys, and so people just didn't really pay that much attention to that. A lot of African Americans rented land rather than owned it as a safety precaution. Under Jim Crow, if an African American landowner gained a lot of property or gained a lot of money, that could easily be targeted by Ku Klux Klan or other kinds of social pressures. And so an interesting strategy that a lot of African-American farmers used was they'd own a small portion of land, and then when prices were good, they'd rent additional land, thereby increasing their income and not calling a lot of attention to themselves. And yet when prices were low, then they could not rent the land and hold on to their relatively small land holdings. So regardless of how many people actually owned land. Mabel's family, of course, still owns the land that they occupy, but there are certainly large numbers of African Americans living in the area. They certainly weren't all landowners, but and there's like I said, there's good reasons for that.
The names of those earliest settlers of Liberia, the McJunkin family, which is a good Ulster Scot or Scots-Irish name, Owens and Glenn. So you traced that, yes, the McJunkins were slaveholders in Pickens County. Mm-hmm. And so, as sometimes happens, slaves chose the surname of their former masters. Mm-hmm. Not always. But that helps you patch the story together.
And there are some local histories, too, that have some anecdotes about former slaves, too. But right, Keith, Chastain, those are some other common names in the upstate of South Carolina, the Illinois Valley area that I'm studying. And there were both blacks and whites that had those names. And of course, as family stories attest, sometimes those names were acquired after the Civil War with interrelationships between whites and blacks that were illegal, but nevertheless certainly took place. And sometimes last names were acquired that way too. And I have some really, really interesting stories in the book about different generations of family relationships between whites and blacks where people recognized they were related to each other and often acknowledged that relationship socially and informally, but certainly not formally.
It's interesting that in not just the oral histories that you did, but it seems like in the 1920s, some of the local newspapers were running stories about African Americans. Now, they were very much a product of their day, and frequently, if they were referring to an African American woman, they called her Auntie, mm-hmm. or you said Mammy.
Yeah, then, that's another word they used.
A male uncle, which the white folks of that day considered a courtesy title rather than just using the first name, never using the last. They wouldn't have said Mrs. McJunkin.
Right.
You've got an obituary in here, which I found absolutely fascinating.
I can add a plug for the Pickens County Library. They've been collecting these, and they were very useful, very helpful.
It's about Aunt.
Oh, the Aunt Katie obituary?
Yeah. There was an
interesting, she was a very prominent African-American woman, very widely known in the upstate. And there was not only an obituary about her, but there was also a what was called a character sketch that was published in, I think it was the Easley Progress in 1927. And so I learned not only a little bit more about her, but also about the area in the 1920s too.
She was Katie Owens. Mm-hmm. Was she one of the original settlers of the area?
She was the farthest back I can get is after the Civil War, I can come upon her name. Some family owned her prior to 1865, and I wasn't sure of who it was. There was a couple of 18 to 20-year-old African Americans, women documented in 1860. I think she was born about 1840. Mm. And I'm not sure how she acquired the last name of Owens. She married a man named Will Owens, but I don't know exactly where he came from. And then she married again and took the last name Terrell.
And actually, her obituary, running the obituary of an African-American in a white newspaper, was fairly unusual mm-hmm. in the 1920s.
Yeah, very true.
You mentioned the character sketch, which appeared on the front page of the Easley Progress.
I was amazed.
And you said it was a two-column article entitled Aunt Katie, describing one of the oldest and most interesting of the few remaining inhabitants of Liberia. So by mid-1920s, Liberia was declining.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And of course, mm-hmm. part of it, by that time, cotton prices have hit rock bottom. The boll weevil has come in, and South Carolina in the early 20s went through about a four-year period of drought. So people fled the Great Migration, particularly to the cities of the Northeast.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to see how that played out locally, too. You're absolutely right.
She was also described as a genuine Southern Mammy,
mm-hmm.
and an interesting character of the hills. She was perhaps one of the most widely known and respected colored women of the county. And it described her dress,
mm-hmm. I thought that was cool.
Again, I think it's fascinating. Aunt Katie still wears the old-time Spencer waist dress, a tight-fitting bodice to the waistline, buttoned up in front, to which is gathered a full skirt with deep and with ample pockets. She always wears a large apron, a snow-white kerchief neatly hemmed by her own fingers, is twined about her head in that coronet style of the old Mammy, binding back the wavy locks, scarcely less white than the folds that confined them. Now, to today's ears, that's very condescending. And probably Aunt Katie didn't appreciate that either. But we have the description of her dress, which might not have appeared otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
Now, her descendants knew about her.
And a lot of local white, like I said, even into the I was here still hearing stories about from older whites as well as blacks about Aunt Katie, people that had stories that they had been told. I agree. I mean, it was you know, given today's values and concepts, it certainly seems to be condescending. But at the time, for an African-American woman to make the front page of the paper, that was extraordinary back in the 1920s.
And it goes on to describe her home. It says, 1 acre of land, a small log cabin of one room constitute Aunt Katie's home. She farmed corn and potatoes as long as she was able to work, and she earned additional income by helping whites in the other communities. And this was published just a year or two prior to her death. Mm-hmm. And then there was her obituary. It says, Aunt Katie Owens, a woman born into slavery, at one time owned by some of the best families in the valley.
Yeah, that struck me interesting.
She was a mother, grandmother, midwife, cook, and laundress, a woman well-respected in her community by both blacks and whites, and the founding matriarch of the last remaining family in Liberia.
Mm-hmm. To me, that nicely summarized her social importance, both among blacks and whites, and also the prevailing attitude of whites over blacks in the 1920s.
The name Liberia, that grabbed my attention. The book came in, I said, Liberia, South Carolina. Where did that come from?
Yeah.
So you've got several theories. And I think that all of the different possibilities should be discussed.
As you read the old bit of Aunt Katie, you notice that even in the 1920s, people were calling it Liberia. And Mabel's mother had the chance to fight to reestablish the name of the road on which the church still stands. And she also wanted it restored as Liberia Road. And so I feel comfortable in knowing that the title is the name of the community, generally speaking, is Liberia. The name could come from several different possibilities. And to me, the less likely possibility is there is a family story that a former slave, Joseph McJunkin, who founded a church near Bald Rock in Greenville County and also then Soapstone and Mount Nebo too, claimed to have come from or remembered that he had come from a region in Africa that by the 1820s was called Liberia. A colony started by the United States to take back freed slaves. I don't know if that's it's a possibility, but that would presuppose that he knew the geographical location of this place and also knew that that place was called now Liberia. To me, the much more likely possibility is that right after the Civil War, there was a movement to transport recently freed slaves again back to Africa, back to Liberia. There was at least one ship that left from Charleston Harbor, taking several hundred freed slaves back. I think a much more likely source of the name comes from as either a metaphor or a sort of a substitute for a local Liberia as a release valve sort of to transport slaves, not back to Africa, but this becomes the little valley became or the area became a metaphor for the Liberia movement. I agree. It was that place name that caught me completely by surprise when I saw it on a road map in upstate South Carolina. I thought, I got to find out more about this place. I had heard about it briefly, and I just wanted to see what it looked like.
Now, it's interesting from those newspaper articles from the 1920s, from the Easley Progress, that they used the term Liberia.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
it was not just something that the African Americans in the area used. The white community recognized that as well.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was very widely known and commonly known. I think even back into the 1880s, I can't remember the oldest printed source, but yes, white people also called it that. You're right, back at least into the 20s.
By the 1920s, particularly young men and women were leaving because farming was bad for everybody. As Ben Robertson, Red Hills and Cotton, would say, you know, these were the draining years.
Mm-hmm. The years that
for everybody.
Bled us. And
they had good land.
Yeah.
The Robertsons had good land. These folks didn't have good land. So they left.
It was really a push-pull kind of situation. There was a lot of social pressure on African-American landowners or land occupiers to leave. It was perceived as a white space, and there was a lot of pressure on local black farmers to get away by whites. But you're right. There were certainly a lot of positive pull factors, much better economic opportunities even in Greenville and Charlotte, let alone Cleveland and Chicago and Boston, where a lot of the local people from Liberia went. There were factories up north that were certainly hiring African Americans. There were better schools, less segregation, and so it was a very positive force pulling a lot of blacks out of the South, as well as whites too. But blacks couldn't work to the same degree in the mills. The mills were segregated, textile mills in the South. So those weren't economic opportunities for blacks as they were for whites. And so, yeah, a lot of them left for, in a sense, better opportunities up north.
You had the statistics about the gradual decline of the black population in this general area of Pickens County, and the white population grew and the African-American population declined, mm-hmm. so that a place like Punkintown became overwhelmingly white in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And part of the consequences of that is that I think by the 1950s and 60s, Upper Pickens County in general, or more specifically, upstate of South Carolina, became more perceived as more of a white space than a black space, unless you're talking about the cities like Pickens. And so part of the reason why I wanted to write the book was to demonstrate that African Americans had always had a significant role to play in the history of the upstate, despite the relatively recent decline. There was a legitimacy to their presence that I thought was important to establish.
Well, how many people actually live in Liberia today?
It's hard to say. Right now, I would say, not counting summer homes, but permanent residents, I would say there's probably about 6 or 7 people that live in the immediate vicinity of Soapstone Baptist Church. There are certainly some white families that live there. There's some recent homes, you know, relatively large homes built in the area as well. In fact, compared to Punkintown, is almost literally a crossroads between two state highways. So Liberia is even less of a community, less of a focused community than that. So we're not talking about a downtown of several buildings or anything like that. That's one of the reasons why I didn't even know I was there when I first discovered it. It's just a cluster of homes that you see very commonly throughout the South, of closely related people who built their homes relatively close to each other and clustered around the church and the old school too, that's still there.
And once upon a time, there were several stores in the general area.
Mm-hmm,
weren't there?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, old-fashioned general stores, but the fact there were two of them, I think, is fascinating.
The one that's called the Burgess Store, the Punkintown General Store, is still there today, and you're welcome to visit. And then right across the road, the highway, is one of the old big white houses of one of the old older families in the area. And that's the crossroads of Punkintown. And there's a few houses nearby, but almost literally a wide spot in the road.
And at the turn of the last century, there were several hundred people living in Punkintown.
Mm-hmm. And the census, you know, usually, you know, for a rural area, there were calling Punkintown sort of the center and then scattered throughout in the rural areas. But a lot of the people, of course, and this is true of a lot of rural areas, a lot of people still want to live on their land and then work in Greenville or work in other places. So they commute back and forth. Today, given good roads, of course, a half an hour commute in order to live on country land is not so problematic, but it certainly was more difficult 100 years ago.
Well, rural churches in South Carolina have been big on having homecoming celebrations. Does Soapstone Baptist have an annual homecoming?
Yes, they do. I attended about 4 or 5 years ago, but it's like probably a lot of rural churches with declining enrollment. It's not like it used to be. There were maybe 15 or 20, well, maybe 30 people at the last one that I attended. There's just not a lot of people left, and that's one of the reasons why Mabel Clark really wants to keep these fish fries going. Is she made a deathbed promise, a literal deathbed promise to her mother, that she would do everything she could to keep this church open and alive, and she's doing her best to do it despite the declining participation.
Well, what about her descendants? Are they in the area? Children? Grandchildren?
She has a son. I'm not sure where he lives. She had a niece who I think was hoping to sort of inherit the responsibility for the fish fry because Mabel's now in her 70s. It's harder and harder for her to keep this up. But she doesn't like to talk much about what's going to happen in the future because I think it stresses her too much. She's hoping that she can get a family member to take over.
Sadly, this is a story that could be said about a lot of rural churches in South Carolina of various denominations. As folks leave the area, it could be a white church, it could be a black church, Methodist, Baptist, and people move away and then there's nobody there. Mm-hmm. It is a struggle to keep it going.
One could make an argument it's the inevitability of changing times. That's certainly true. And you're right, it's a very common challenge. Personally, I would hate to see that happen to this particular community and this particular church because it represents, to me anyway, and I think to the members of the church, it still represents so much. It represents a portion of South Carolina history that I think needs to be added to the whole story of South Carolina. I think it represents the struggles and the challenges that African Americans have faced in our country, in our state, and in local communities. And so I think it's an important representation of those struggles. And so personally, I'd like to see it keep going.
Mike, we need to pause for a moment,
sure.
Let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Professor John Mike Coggeshall from Clemson University about his book, Liberia, South Carolina, an African-American Appalachian Community. You mentioned that the local history room in the Pickens County Library was very helpful to you, and so obviously there are folks that recognize the importance of this, right?
I will tell you that one of the things that I found really helpful, and so I would encourage families to do this, is I found it less helpful to read generations of who begat whom, but I found it a lot more helpful and a lot more interesting to read stories that families remembered about family members, because embedded in those stories are often interesting historical facts that when you can put them together, help to paint a much more vivid picture of a general history. Or another way to put it is it makes history come alive. To read these snippets of family stories, both from blacks and from whites, about what it was like locally back in whatever decade we're talking about really helps make that decade come alive. And they were not only fun to read, but I think they added a lot to the general narrative of my book.
I've got your book here. Have you got a favorite story you'd like to read?
Gosh. There are certainly some tragic stories. And I think that's important to point out that part of the reason for doing the book is that I wanted to document the challenges that African Americans face too. But I daily life has some rather humorous episodes or anecdotes. And I think they're more not laugh out loud funny, but more sort of the typical kinds of maybe the kinds of stories we'd put in Facebook today about what my kid did. The two stories that come to mind, and I can maybe summarize them, story that Mabel was telling about shelling beans on her front porch one day when she was a teenager, I guess, and her little nephew, who must have been about two or three at the time, shoved a bean up his nose, and nobody noticed him doing it, and then a couple of days later, they saw a green sprout coming out of his nose. Frankly, I was a little suspicious, but anyway, they took him to the doctor and had that bean sprout removed. And then another story I thought was really kind of cute was the story that Mabel's first cousin told, where when she was a little girl, she always loved animals, she said, and when she was a little girl, she found a stray dog wandering through the neighborhood. And so she felt sorry for the little dog. So she took off her winter coat and put buttoned up her winter coat on the little dog and took off her little hat and put her hat on the dog. And then she said, and the dog went strolling off down the road and I never saw the dog or my coat again. And I thought that was kind of funny to imagine a little girl doing that. But I think as an example, I think maybe the last couple of closing paragraphs, I think, capture sort of like the essence of what I was trying to do. But I could ask if you had a favorite story that I could read for you.
Well, there are two, and I think these both fall into the tragic category.
Okay.
William Owens. Mm-hmm. In the 1880 census, William Owens, the youngest son of Katie Owens, was listed as black, but his grandchildren had always heard that he was white. The 1910 census had three children, and then William disappears. He had to leave because he didn't know whether he was black or white.
That happened several times. There's another family story about Esley Owens, who is Mabel's father's brother, and he disappeared for that same reason.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it was so tough, it's so difficult back in Jim Crow that certainly whites and blacks weren't officially supposed to mix.
And he was a tall man, looked like any white guy, and he fled because a white woman favored him. And he jumped in the river and swam underwater until he got out of the range of the sheriff and the KKK shooting at him. And then he disappeared from the family knowledge. He hitched a ride up north.
And that's another reason why people left, like I said, is there was a lot of social pressure on African-American occupiers of land that this is a white space and you don't belong here.
Yeah. You also mentioned that in talking to Mabel and the present generation, they referred stories of their parents that those who were newly freed frequently didn't want to talk about their experiences, particularly if any white person was around.
Mm-hmm. We see this in the WPA files too. I had looked at some WPA ex-slave narratives for another book that I wrote a couple decades ago. And I think it's important for a white audience to understand the difference between an older black person talking to us and an older black person talking to their own relatives in a more of a safe space. And I think that's why getting some of these, like I said, these local family histories that both oral and written, if they are, that tell what life was like for enslaved African Americans or even under the oppression of Jim Crow, what it was really like to feel that terror, to feel that social pressure, to feel that hatred or that mistrust that you just never knew from one moment to the next, from one day to the next, what could happen. And I think that was very powerful to try to put into words what it would have and must have and still does feel like to African Americans so that we whites can maybe understand that a little better. And there's a lot of stories of that. I remember a story that an African American had told somebody else that I was able to document from a secondary source, that his family story had a story where one of his enslaved ancestors, his young white owner said, "Kneel down in front of me." And she knelt, I think it was a she, knelt down in front of her. The white woman took her shoe off, smacked the African-American slave girl in the face with her shoe, and then said, "Put my shoe back on." And the narrator said, "That's what slavery was like." And that story, I think, just a little story and a little family history, but that really encapsulated that just utter horror of slavery.
Well, you have a story about Lonzo Glenn, who got into a scuffle in a store, and a local deputy intervened, and he responded, bit the white guy's nose all the way off, bit his ears off, and bit a chunk out of his face. And then he fled to Liberia.
And that was an interesting episode, too. He hid out in Mabel's father's barn for several days. Mabel's, I think it was one of her older brothers, remembered that his father poured kerosene around the barn to make sure that tracking dogs couldn't find him. And then it was a real interesting strategy. And I think it shows the kinds of strategies and resilience that African Americans not only were forced to utilize, but came up with on their own to maintain and fool their white oppressors. But he filled his wagon with hay for 3 days, drove it over to his family's house in northern Greenville County near Bald Rock. And each day that he drove that wagon, he wasn't stopped by whites looking for this fugitive. So then on the third day, he loaded Lonzo Glenn under the hay and hauled him up to his relatives at Bald Rock. And then his relatives at Bald Rock marked a trail up through the Blue Ridge and said, get on that trail, head into North Carolina and disappear. And that's what he did. And that's another reason why, as I said, people had to leave. But I think to me that the interesting thing about that story is not only the horror of having to flee your homeland just because you fight back, but the resilience and the strength that African Americans showed in solving these problems for themselves and maintaining their own dignity at the same time.
Well, you end your epilogue, the story of the Liberia community, open with the tragedy of the church burning and the challenges to the truth of the Liberia story. And this book has presented evidence that the community persists despite that event and equally other pernicious ones. Today, large portions of ancestral McJunkins and Owens land remains in family ownership, and Owens and McJunkin descendants still occupy that same land.
Mm-hmm. That's true. There's McJunkins, Mabel's mother's family still owns land near Bald Rock, South Carolina, up near Caesar's Head, and they still live on that land too. And Mabel's family still owns the core of her father's farmland, and she and a couple of her brothers still live there.
Well, and then there was the Great Commission that Katie Owens, Aunt Katie, that we referred to, gave to her daughter.
Oh, that's Lula Owens. That's Mabel's mother that asked Mabel for the rest of her life, you know, whatever you do, keep the doors of that church open. And to me, that became a really powerful way to kind of think about ending the story. And then I try to think about the last little episode is imagining a young enslaved girl named Katie standing on these exposed soapstone boulders that one can still climb on today and wondering if she'd ever be free. And sorry, I always get choked up thinking about this. But imagining that little girl, that little enslaved girl standing on that rock, looking out over that same valley that you can look out at today, and just wondering if she'd ever be free, and thinking about in the century and a half since she was born, the tremendous waves of social change that have swept over that area, and the tremendous kinds of positive changes that have occurred to her descendants and that she never could have imagined, or maybe she could barely have hoped that those changes would have occurred. And what I like to think about is the great-granddaughter of that same enslaved girl now has her own human dignity. She has her own human rights. She has her own last name that enslaved girl didn't even have. She is no one's property. And to me, I think that's a tremendous story. The story of, in this case, one extended family, but it's a story of I hope, the African-American experience in the United States. That transformation of what it was like to live in enslavement to the kinds of changes that have occurred, I was going to say certainly mostly positive, but still the challenges that remain today, and to try to capture that sense of the African American experience for a general readership.
Well, this attachment to place and land, which Southerners, black or white, really have, the Great Commission, as you call it, that Mabel Owens Clark got, you describe it, and it really is gripping. And her mother's on her deathbed, and her had had a stroke, and she grasped Mabel's hands and looked at her, and she said, "You make sure as long as you live and the breath of God is in you that you keep the doors of that church open." And she held my hand so tight. She said, "Will you make that promise? Whatever it takes, whatever you have to do to keep that church doors open, don't let that door close." And there was a pause. "And that's why I do what I do."
That's what she said.
Mike, Alfred's given me the wind-up sign. Are there any last words you'd like to say to our listeners before we sign off today?
I appreciate being asked to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity to present the story of this community to a wider audience. It's a very powerful story, and as you were just reading that quote, I was getting choked up again. And I hope Black readers certainly see it as a part of their own history, and I hope white readers see it as a part of the state's history. And despite the kinds of challenges that African Americans face, that we respect and support the challenges today.
Okay. Well, Mike Coggeshall, professor of anthropology at Clemson University, author of Liberia, South Carolina, an African American Appalachian Community, thank you so much for being with us today on the Journal. This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's Journal. I did, and I learned something. The perception of upcountry South Carolina as being predominantly and overwhelmingly white is something that has been in the history books since the early 20th century. But the presence of a place like Liberia, an all-African American community in the Appalachian Mountains, is something that really was not known. Professor Coggeshall has done a wonderful job ferreting out information about this place, its people, and their attachment to this place that they called Liberia. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.